Hello, welcome again to the Comic Connoisseurs. Tonight we'll be talking about EC Comics and Charlton Comics and the era of horror comics. Of course, I'm my co-host, J.D. from Saskatoon.
The Children of the Night. What interesting comics they read.
And also with us are a couple of special guests. We have Jeffrey Wessel.
Hello.
I hope I pronounced that correctly.
You did.
Okay. And Bryant Dillon.
Hello.
And like I said, we're going to talk about horror comics, specifically the EC Charlton era. But let's first talk about the weekly solicitations here. Interestingly enough, looking here, we have AC Comics has Crypt of Horror, Volume 22. So that's a little topical right there. Let's see here. We have some new Gold Digger from Antarctic Press.
That book's still going on, huh?
Yeah. Fred, you say what you want about Fred Perry. He's a workhorse.
I haven't read any of that since the very early days, and in the very early days of Antarctic Press, too. So, good for him. I mean, you know, keeping an indie book going on that long is, you know, damn near impossible in today's market. So, good for him.
Yes.
You know, it's the same thing like with, what is it, Jim Balin's book, the tarot book. It's rightly made fun of, but in today's market, getting a self-published title beyond issue 12 is a major accomplishment. So.
Yes. We also have Archie Comics, Betty and Veronica Friends Jumbo Comic Digest. we have a couple of listeners who are Archie fans, so we always have to mention that. I really don't see anything I want to talk about with Avatar Press this week. Let's move on. We have
I missed this week's Uber, so no. But that is a fantastic book overall. It's a little gory, you know, a bit more gory work than Kieran Gillen usually does, but it's pretty good work, honestly. Yeah.
So we got,
and I had to big up Kanan White because he's, you know, a fellow Hoosier, lives in Fort Wayne, Indiana, so.
I see something JT likes from Boom Studio.
Big Trouble in Little China?
Yes.
Oh, you know what? I wouldn't have looked at this twice if not for the fact that, well, two things. One, Carpenter is actively writing the script in accordance with Eric Powell, who created The Goon. And this is the greatest sequel that was never made for this movie. and they get, like, when you read the dialogue of Jack Burton in here, you hear Kurt Russell's voice. You know, you hear Victor Wong as Egg Shen, and they name the demon Pete. Like the one, have you guys seen Big Trouble in Little China, I'm assuming?
Well, of course, yeah. I saw it in the theater, so.
But yeah, like that demon that comes up from underneath the truck at the end of the film, Jack essentially adopts and names him Pete. And then they crash. Oh, God. I just watched it like last week already.
We don't need to go through a whole list.
Just basically, they crash his best friend's wedding and they end up having to go on some wild, crazy China themed alternate world road trip to save his best friend's soul. So, of course, there's a lot of the Pork Chop Express.
So, let's see here. We have
let's not forget Lumberjanes out this week from Boom as well.
That is such a good one.
It is. I mean, my daughter hoards that book, so I haven't even had a chance to read it yet.
I love I think it's the one character of Riley that's essentially, she's like Finn from Adventure Time, except on a permanent sugar high.
That's probably true.
Yeah.
So let's move further down the list. We have some Dark Horse here. We have an Alley Oop to Complete Sundays Volume 2 for those people who like the classics. Alley Oop, really? Nobody, really?
I know Alley Oop. I just
I never read it, but I'm fully aware of what it is. But
and we also have Usagi Yojimbo Senso number 2 of 6.
And we also Comics in Action. the self-published Kickstarter success story. And you know, Art and Franco are great people too. So we've been to that store several times in Skokie, Illinois. So good place.
So we have DC Comics, and moving on.
Oh, you didn't know this week is the return of the Eyebleed comics, which I take that to mean, remember last year when they had the Villains Month and they had the, you were lucky if you did get a regular cover. They had all those holographic covers. Well, they're back. All these Futures End number ones are all holographic covers again. Oh, Speculator boy. Market, take notice.
This is what sunk Marvel in the 90s. Anyways, that's a rant for
with the same editor-in-chief. Go figure.
Although they do have the new edition of Grant Morrison's JLA Earth 2, which I finally have that in my possession.
The thing is this, is Grant Morrison isn't the architect of this whole universe. That's the whole line, and that's the problem, because the thing is you have the wrong architects in place. I don't care who you have working on single tiles. DC has a problem that it's not going to solve until they oust who's in management.
Well, yeah, but I was specifically...
But they don't see... But the biggest problem is that they don't think they have a problem.
But they do.
Well, no, they don't think that.
But they do.
Yeah. But I was talking just in the respect that, you know, with this JLA Earth 2, it's one of my favorite Grant Morrison works. I mean, I've tried to read Invisibles, and I kind of like it, but it's like when you read that one book that's just a little bit over your head that you don't quite get it. This one I got, so it's... And it's okay. It's Earth 2. I mean, who doesn't love evil versions of superheroes? Can that ever be said?
Okay, so let's move a little bit further down. We have Dynamite Entertainment. We have Alice Cooper, number one.
Yeah, apparently that was...
Why is Alice Cooper still a thing?
Yeah. What happens in an Alice Cooper comic?
He goes to the store and buys some cereal.
I picked this one up just because, well, I grew up listening to all my dad's music, and he liked Alice Cooper. It's based somewhat off of the whole mythos he created with the Welcome to My Nightmare.
Okay.
And
that's not really a mythos. I mean,
well, no, because they did some comics with that for, like, Marvel, I think, published the Welcome to My Nightmare or some, like, Alice Cooper-themed comic back in the day.
There was also a Muppet Show bit, too.
Yeah, and I think the story in this is essentially Alice Cooper. He's like this Sandman-like character, and, you know, wacky hijinks ensues.
So, let's see here. We have Blood Queen number 4. That sounds kind of interesting and sort of on topic this week. It is not, but we have Red Sonja. I always like to talk about Red Sonja.
And what aspect of Red Sonja do you like the most, Ben?
Well, you know, the whole gritty universe, cover by Amanda Connor. let's see.
See, I love Amanda Connor's art, but I just don't think she can do grim and gritty.
Have you seen the cover she did for Red Sonja?
Oh, yeah. It's good. It's just... There's always that softness to her work, and it's not a bad thing. It's just... It's not Boris Vallejo, so just saying.
Yeah. So moving further down the list here, we have Angry Birds. Well, first we have Heavy Metal 270.
I can recommend a strip in that because there is a new edition of a British strip called Vampire Vixens of the Wehrmacht by Alex Ronald. Or is it Roland? I can't remember. But the main part is that my frequent letterer, Jim Campbell, did some work on this, too. Ah. So.
Well, we had
Vampire Vixens, and I was like, I'm sold.
We also have Angry Bird number 4.
Oh, and soon we'll have Angry Birds Transformers.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's just a bad idea. We have a Judge Dredd volume here, so that's always good to collect. Yeah. We also
Rocketeer.
Yeah, Rocketeer. We have some pretty good stuff from IDW this week. See, here we have on Image Comics, we have
I don't really see God hates even... astronauts.
That sounds
God horrible. Hates astronauts. It is fantastic.
Oh, wow, the cover sold me.
Yes, well, and of course, I also have to give special mention to the best book this week, Southern Bastards number 4. That was a fantastic wrap up to this first arc that Jason's Aaron and Latour have cooked up, and it's a hell of a book. It really is.
I have to check that one out.
Yeah, definitely. The first trade is going to be out, I think, in a few weeks. $9.99. You know, one of the those Image first volumes at $9.99. Definitely worth it. It's fantastic.
And they got the new Hack/ Son of Sam Haines. Something I'll mention probably towards the end there. Just as far as horror comics go, always love that series.
We also have here Knights of the Dinner Table number 212.
That's still going.
Yes, it is. Going further down, we have Kill My Mother graphic novel. That sounds kind of...
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. I have not read that yet. I am definitely looking forward to it. It's by Jules Pfeiffer.
Ooh.
The seminal cartoonist from The Village Voice. You know, wrote the book, The Comic Book Heroes, which is a lot of people's introduction to this wonderful medium.
So we also have Marvel Comics, and moving on, we have...
Well, it's not that bad. You don't want to talk about the death of Wolverine, Ben?
Well, this is, what, his sixth or seventh time?
Yeah, but there's also Hawkeye versus Deadpool, which I actually picked up, and it's a lot of fun. Okay. That's the one thing I can honestly say the last couple of years of Marvel Comics, despite the constant renumberings at number ones and... Every other month is an earth-shattering status quo event. At least their earth-shattering status quo events are, by and large, a lot of fun to read, even if you can't afford to buy every single tie-in comic. You can still just read the core series and come away with a good story, unlike a certain other event, Forever Evil. And what else we got? Legendary Star-Lord, which, again, a lot of fun to read if you're a big Guardian of the Galaxy
who?
Fan. Legendary Star-Lord. You know? Oh, never mind.
But
I almost became Star-Lord today, except they were sold out of the Star-Lord Nerf gun blasters at Target.
So let's move a little bit further down. We're almost done with the solicitation. So you know what? I think this is a good point to just say, you know, we're wrapping up with the solicitations. We'll take a brief break. And when we come back, we will have the topic of the show.
It's time for intermission, boys and girls.
Like animation? Come listen to Animation Aficionados.
And if you disagree with us, you could be a guest on a future show.
Available on iTunes, the Zune Market, and animationaficionados.com.
Hey, I'm Gary.
I'm Mike.
I'm Chuck.
And I'm Justin.
Join the four of us every week on the Internet's number one and longest-running G.I. Joe podcast, What's on Joe Mind?
It's Joe news, reviews, and interviews like you've never heard them before, delivered right to your MP3 player.
Our guests include Jason Marsden, Kevin Michael Richardson, and Matt Yang King from G.I. Joe Renegades, Larry Hama, Robert Adkins, and John Barber from IDW Publishing, and many more from around the online Joe community.
Yeah, it's guys talking about Joe. Think of it as Joe Talk meets Sports Talk. And we make fun of Chuck.
Right, and we... Hey, again?
Come on, Chuck. We're just kidding, kinda.
Sometimes Chuck makes fun of himself.
Right, and we... Okay, seriously, this is just getting ridiculous now.
It's What's on Joe Mind, every week on the Geekcast Radio Network, InsidePulse.com, Stitcher Smart Radio, and iTunes. Download and listen today.
I suppose I still can't say something about Transformers, can I?
Good grief.
What about sports?
That sounds good.
Yeah, that's all right.
It's action. It's drama. It's comedy. It's Decian, the superhero webcomic. Decian's got superhero antics and sexy girls. Read it now at Decian.com. Decian.com.
And now, back to the show.
And we're back to talk about the horror comic age, and specifically EC and Charlton Comics. I'll start here. Pardon me. I'll start here because I have a little bit of a personal connection to this. How many people are familiar with the Charlton comic Midnight Tales?
I am.
All right.
I've heard of it, never read it, but I've heard of it.
Okay. Well, Midnight Tales is a little bit close to me because Midnight Tales, in case you didn't know, was a story about it was an ongoing horror anthology story about where you follow this main character, Professor Coffin, and his rather comely young niece as they go and have different adventures and they see different horrific things and stuff like that. You know, sometimes they're just most of the time they're just observers in these stories, but the reason why this is close to me is the writer and the artist of Midnight Tales was one Wayne Howard, who, if you didn't know, was a father figure and mentor to me while I was growing up. He taught me how to ink comics. He told me many stories that he knew from the industry in the past. I really did look up to him like a father. And he tragically passed away just a couple of years back. But that's really, my connection to Midnight Tales.
Wow, that's awesome.
Well, it's always good to have a personal connection to something, you know, even if it's, purely sentimental, but, have something even more meaningful.
Well, the thing with Midnight Tales is that you got to remember is Charlton was like the David to everybody else's Goliath back then, because everything Charlton did was on barely a budget. Their printers were old cereal box printers. The talent they got, which was good talent. I mean, they had Ditko in their stable, were mostly people who were pissed off at the big two. And, they worked really, really hard with what no one else would work with. And the thing with, Midnight Tales is something, is a story where you can almost feel that Wayne is trying to sneak as much in as possible past the restrictive code,
Sure.
Which a lot of horror comics try to do, go ahead.
Oh, it's funny. Over the summer, the Tuesday after C2E2 back in April, I actually had the occasion to drive to Columbus, Ohio, and saw a talk by Steve Bissett. Most people remember him for being the primary penciler on Alan Moore's Swamp Thing run.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he gave a great talk about the code and the collapse of the code and how it really did kind of eviscerate horror and crime and even romance comics.
Yes.
So it's a fascinating look at the world from that era.
Because I remember, and I've told Ben this before, I remember reading the very first three or four issues of Midnight Tales, because my grandma, like so many other members of my family, are pack rats, and she kept everything. So I'm digging through her basement years ago, and I find these two old paper bags that are just full of old Silver Age and early Bronze Age comics. And in there, there's a bunch of old Gold Key and some EC, and then there's the first issue of Midnight Tales, and just that whole anthology, the professor, was it Doctor or Professor Coffin?
It was Professor Coffin.
But, Professor Coffin, he's going off with, Ben said, his rather attractive young niece, and they always run into these weird things that spin off into their own little stories, and that's the earliest thing I can remember getting me into horror comics was those first three issues like that. And then discovering EC Comics, like I said, later on in the early mid-90s when they had these reprints. And it's just the sort of thing, not the goriest, but it's some of the hardcore horror stories, stuff you wouldn't maybe be able to watch as a film, but it's the medium of comics. It makes it more palatable. You can digest this easy reading stuff like this. Because I remember reading, did Bernie Wrightson ever do art for EC?
No, I think it was way before Bernie Wrightson's time.
Okay. It's just because I remember this one story is this guy who is this doctor, and he's trying to create the perfect bride or something. It's very Frankensteinian in this story. And it's the story he'll dump all the spare body parts that he's aren't working for him into this bog. And this one day his car breaks down and all these bent creatures rise out of the muck, and it's somehow all these body parts have like fused together in like these grotesque creatures, and they tear him apart and sew him back together, so he is now like them. And it's like one of those, you know, be careful what you wish for sort of moments. And it's just, like I said, EC Comics got me into like a lot of different horror. Like, it got me into horror movies, because growing up as a kid, I didn't want to watch, I'd watch the old Universal Monster movies, because those were pretty well safe. But I didn't get into, like, you know, stuff like gorier horror movies, like, you know, like Friday and Nightmare and like that at the time, until after I started reading EC Comics and kind of finessed my way into that world. So, I mean, it was definitely a door opener for me.
Well, see, I did almost the opposite. Oh, I was going to say, I did almost the opposite, where I, as a kid, I think I got into some of the like 80s horror films like Creepshow and Tales from the Dark Side, and things that were based on these anthologies that were based on the comics that had preceded them. Just by going to the local library as a kid, I was able to, you know, find those reprints you were talking about as collections and just devour them. And I think something that you were getting at was that, like a lot of great things in child entertainment, at least things that I can remember from my childhood that were beloved to me, it didn't really speak down to me. I mean, it was a little salacious. It could be gory and extreme, but it didn't make you feel like something was being watered down or dumbed down for you. You felt like, oh, this is something that's treating me as an adult, you know, even though it does have a bend towards the child audience.
You know, we're talking about horror comics. I think we're forgetting the biggest name in horror comics, Tales from the Crypt, when it was a comic.
Yes, right.
Well, who doesn't love Crypty?
Well, you know, it's funny that, you know, one of my earliest introductions, you know, I was never a huge horror fan until I was much older, until I was in high school. And that was more to do with Alan Moore's Swamp Thing and the movies at the time and Clive Barker. But I remember vividly there is a book by Les Daniels called Comics, C-O-M-I-X. And this book had everything up to a certain point. It was published in the mid-70s. But this book had everything from an early issue of Action Comics where Lois Lane became Superwoman to the absolute most racist Captain America story ever devised involving Japanese vampires. But it also, you know, everything from that to Robert Crumb and the Furry Freak Brothers. But smack in the middle of this book was a reprint of an old EC horror tale. And I still vividly remember this story because it was kind of the secret origin of the old witch. You know, because they had the three horror hosts. The Crypt Keeper, the old witch, and the vault.
Wasn't the Gravedigger or something? Or
something Vault like Keeper. That. Vault Keeper, yeah, something like that. But anyway, it was a story of, you know, a werewolf and a vampire basically shacking up. This is how the old witch was born. Yeah, I just always got to remember that. And there was another, I think it wasn't a Charlton one, it was a Warren. I think it was from an issue of Creepy. Horror comic about a horror comic, an artist who was kind of chiseling three other artists. All he did was the panel borders, but he hired one guy to write the script, one guy to draw it, the other one to ink it, and he was ripping them off and not taking any credit, you know, or not giving any credit. So it was, you know, one of those tales of revenge from there. But yeah, I remember reading those at an early age, and I also remember at the library reading the comic book adaptation of Creepshow long before I ever got to see the movie.
Ah.
So yes, and, you know, the you know, so yes, a lot of Bernie Wrightson art and the word meteor shit stuck with me for a good long time.
Yeah, I remember Creepshow, like the movies, what got me into watching those, like, after I read the EC, and that was like those animated bookends to the whole thing, which was really trippy. I just remember, and with a lot of, like, specifically EC, it's like, I remember reading all those reprints through my childhood, like the 90s, and then learning about the code and the Seduction of the Innocent, and me growing to hate Dr. Wortham, because clearly that guy had some skeletons and tutus in his closet.
Well, the book, it's funny, because the book that I mentioned that had everything actually reprinted the then-current comics code. And you read this, and it's ridiculous. Apparently, I mentioned earlier when we were off the air, basically my partner came from communist Poland, and when I showed her a copy of the comics code online, she looked at me straight up and said, even the Russians didn't have something like this. You know, just putting into words is how fascistic this was. You know, one of the stories Steve Bissett told in that talk was when they were going through, there was a Ron Goulart's documentary about comic books in the 90s, and you know, during the 1950s, you know, they actually held rallies burning comic books.
Yeah.
Well, this footage was shown, and he told me he remembers being in Germany at the time at a screening of this, and during the scene where they're showing the burnings of these comic books, all the Germans in the room just fell dead silent. You thought that they saw a ghost, because in a way they kind of did.
Right.
This is so I mean, yeah, the whole idea behind the code was it was pretty fascistic in nature. Not even the Catholic Church didn't even sign off on this. They thought it was that bad.
The whole idea of the code was, and Wortham himself is, Wortham was the opposite of what a scientist does, because a scientist doesn't start with conclusions, start working backwards and to try to find evidence that validates the conclusion. He works forward, and he observes, and then comes up with a conclusion. And, you know, someone tried to make a big deal about Wortham was recently debunked yet again. But the thing is, anyone who's even looked at his research as he presented it could poke holes in it, because he's, you know, like I said, someone who starts with a conclusion and works backwards will always have holes in their argument.
Well, it's funny that Wortham himself didn't like the comics code. He thought it didn't do enough. He thought it was a Band-Aid. He thought it was a Band-Aid over a knife wound.
Yeah, see, the thing is with Wortham and the comics code, I think the real reason it got so much traction as it did back in the day is this is coming. They weren't all that far removed from, like, the Red Scare of the 1950s. You know, we've all got a communist living in our closet or something like that. And I think that's why a lot of people were still trying to, you know, they didn't want anything tainting their so-called way of life. So, I mean, that's what I think, at least one reason why it got as much as it did. What?
I think part of the problem was, you know, you look at all these other creators we're talking about, the creators of the superhero genre at the time, and you know, I hate to say it, but William Marston was pretty much the poster of this is who's corrupting our youth. I mean it's William Marston, you know, contributed quite a bit to the superhero genre, but you know, his personal life was, well, you know, it's like, holy shit. I mean, especially, you know, today you turn some heads, but back then, holy shit.
Well, it's worth pointing out that the Comics Code, of course, was a self-regulatory body, and it was hammered home by many of the companies. It's no coincidence that the last two remaining subscribers before it was all said and done were DC and Archie. And it's no coincidence that they were two of the primary architects of writing the code, because essentially they were totally trying to drive EC out, and you know, and they would have succeeded had they not fallen upon the idea of turning Mad from a comic book into a magazine, and thereby bypassing the code altogether.
Yep, and that was. You know, one of the contributors to Horror Comics back then was also one of the main contributors to Mad back then. We're talking about Wallace Wood, or as his friends knew him as Woody, another troubled individual. But, you know, it's... So the one thing I really enjoyed about the horror comics of this era is the visuals were great, you know, especially the stuff that's outright eldritch, outright almost Lovecraftian. But at the same time, the writers, the editors, the artists themselves knew when to sort of keep that veil on, you know, or as I like to say, don't show the monster, because the terror of what it could be is so much greater than just showing it at times, you know?
Yeah, it's sometimes what you don't see that's worse.
Well, you know, but you can still get that today. If we want to divert a little bit to talk about the modern era, I'm probably one of the few people who will actually say this, but the first series of Cross, the original 8-issue series by Garth Ennis and Jason Burroughs, actually had some of the best psychological horror out there. You just wouldn't know it because everybody gave up after issue one, you know, with that, you know, the spectacular violence of that double page spread of family getting slaughtered. But I insist that the absolute most horrific scene in the very first series of Cross actually happened off panel. And sorry to spoiler this, when the two lead characters were faced with the horrible choice of having to kill these children that had gone cannibal when they were hiding out from the Cross. So it was either we take these kids and they're already so scarred that they can't function, or we let the Cross get them, so they shoot them. But you never see them shooting them. You see the guns firing, you never see the kids dying. And, you know, that sort of thing is kind of a lost art, but you can still find it out there.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely present for good writers that to know how to use it. I know it's been used a few times effectively in The Walking Dead. I can even think of times in, like, some of Joss Whedon's Buffy Season 8 where they've taken moments like that and learned to almost draw it more cinematically. To a degree, where you're focusing on a character's emotions or a empty room while you know something horrific is happening off panel.
Yeah, I mean, there was a. Have you guys ever read Hack Slash?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and like, you know, it's a great send up of like all the conventions of like 80s slasher flicks and all that. But they had it might have just been a single issue story of one of the ongoings a few years ago where the main protagonist Cassie Hack, who's like the girl that survives the horror movie, she runs across a bunch of these kids who have been infected with essentially the rage virus. Sorry, like there's a whole backstory about why slashers are, and they're infected with a variation of this virus that creates slashers, and they've gone like past the Lord of the Flies sort of crazy. And her big backup Vlad's like, you know, what are we got to save these kids. And Cassie's like, there's no saving them. And you see Vlad's going back to the van and you hear like just from off screen, crack, crack. And you see Cassie walking back to their vehicle and you take off. They don't say a bloody thing, but, you know, it's implied that Cassie, who doesn't ever want to kill kids, you know, she had to, you know, take that step. And it's just, no words, it's just the art that just sells that moment. And that's some of the scariest things you ever... I thought one of the scarier things you ever seen, that it wasn't like some jigsaw-faced serial killer. It's a bunch of kids that just lost their damn minds. So, but I mean, at least for some of my friends growing up, how, and me, that we even further got us into horror comics was like how Marvel... You know, back in the 70s when black and white magazine size comics.
Well, are you leaning the Tomb of Dracula?
Well, yeah. Just like go from like, you look at how Marvel went, they had like Adventure into Fear with Morbius the Living Vampire. They had the Tomb of Dracula, both the black and white magazine and the ongoing comic, which was like up until... I think one of the biggest leaps Marvel had ever taken away from the comics code was like the drug issue with Harry Osborn back in the day. But after that, the Tomb of Dracula was like the biggest step to the right of the comics code that Marvel had done up until that point. And it has gone on to be like one of, I think it's pretty well, I think a lot of people consider it to be like a high point of horror comics. it not just not in the respect that it's really gory, but it really kind of had that same flavor of a lot of the old Christopher Lee Hammer horror Dracula films, where they take Dracula and, you know, he's drinking their blood, he's trying to take over the world, but they almost present him in this very noble light. And just that just grabbed readers for, I mean, how long did that comic run? Like 12 years, something like that?
Well, it also created some interesting artifacts in Marvel. Specifically, it actually ran 7 years, but it creates some interesting artifacts in Marvel where you had where you have stories where Dracula is a supervillain and he's fighting Spider-Man, and it's like okay, that's different.
Or where he turned Storm into his vampire bride, and she went around the X-Mansion seducing and turning a bunch of the other X-Men.
Yes.
And then he fought Jesus in that one issue.
Yes. Like I said, it creates these weird artifacts in the Marvel Universe because the thing is, something self-contained like Tomb of Dracula is great. But, you know, the whole universe mixing thing, you get some really weird-ass issues. And, pardon me for saying, you also get weird things like Thanos fighting Spider-Man for Hostess Cupcakes or something. And I know that's not what really happened, but
you can drag that all that goes back to, I would say, like, I mean, the Universal monster movies work that stuff perfectly with having obviously they had a few boring films as well, but they loved to mix those characters and pair them up and have that sort of connected universe before it's become, you know, it's the popularity it is now.
I mentioned Morbius the Living Vampire earlier, which was another step that the creative process that went into that I think is really fascinating, in that they actually sat down and, well, you look at the code and it says you can't have any supernatural vampires, like you can't have these supernatural creatures. So I think it was Roy Thomas was one of the creators of Morbius, if I'm not mistaken.
The Living Vampire. Actually,
the Living Vampire, yeah, he's the Living Vampire. They came up with a scientifically somewhat implausible explanation involving bat.
Somewhat implausible.
Well, I want to say plausible, it's not implausible. I mean, it's...
As plausible as the other...
This is back when everyone had transistors in their equipment, so it doesn't matter.
Everyone bought all their lab equipment from the same place that Dr. Frankenstein got his, you know, glowy voltage pyramid cone things. I know there's an actual name for them, I just can't remember. But yeah, like Morbius was this prize-winning scientist. He had like this super advanced form of like anemia, and he tries to cure his blood disease using bat juices, and that doesn't work, but then they're still in his system, and he figures, oh, what the hell, electroshock therapy, and then that's what causes his mutation. And at least the original Morbius, you know, did the right thing and drank blood by biting people with his fangs, not by gripping their throats really hard like in the Spider-Man cartoon.
That piece of shit.
Oh, guys. Okay, and I was like, what breed of vampire bat has...
What?
Well, no, I love it too. I love it. It's just, what breed of vampire bat has octopus-like suckers on itself?
Doesn't want blood, but plasma. Must have plasma.
The breed being sold on a Saturday morning cartoon.
The thing is this, they could have gotten a vampire if the showrunner, John Semper, knew how to talk to censors, but he didn't.
Or at least somebody with like a more plausible Eastern European accent. But I mean, you look at all the great work that Marvel did with like Tomb of Dracula, Morbius, and the Man Thing, which is another great horror character. You know, if what knows fear burns at the Man Thing's touch. I mean, I remember reading some of those like black and white reprints of early Man Thing stories and giant sized Man Thing. I love saying that out loud. Just although the movie that they made out of that was just dreadful. You know, that stuff in the 70s is great. And, I mean, throughout the 80s, you had horror-type characters here and there. I mean, there's a Werewolf by Night where, you know, the Moon Knight first showed up, which is another great Marvel horror character. You had, like, the very early, I'd say almost the complete run of the Johnny Storm Ghost Rider was a great horror comic, because it's this guy, you know, at first he can't control his change, and then he finds out he's bonded to this demon, and he's got to fight literally against himself in order to try to free himself from this curse. And that leads into the, you know, the, I'd say half and half good, bad run of Marvel horror comics in the 90s through the Midnight Suns line. You know, it brought back Ghost Rider for a few years before they brought back the rest of the characters. I mean, he brought back Morbius. They brought back Frank Drake and Hannibal King and Blade from Tomb of Dracula. Yeah. They created, and those early issues were really good. I mean, towards the end of that run, because it only lasted, I think, like maybe 3 or 4 years, all said and done. You know, they brought Doctor Strange back to the fore and injected a whole lot more horror elements in there. And they, was it the Darkhold comic that they came out? I really love the Darkhold comic, because this is, in Marvel, they've got the Darkhold, which is basically their Necronomicon. They've got C'thon, which is their Cthulhu. And it was all about this small group of people, a government agent, a English occult history professor, and this woman who is somehow tied to the unimaginable evil beyond the grave. And they have to track down this little black dwarf that's handing out these letters with all sorts of arcane symbols that basically, it's like Tales from the Crypt one page at a time. You know, these people say the spell and they get their wish, but it's in a horribly perverted form. And through all of this, I mean, they had the backstory of, like, Lilith, the mother of all demons, trying to, you know, come back into the world and take over. And they had some good crossovers. But once those initial creators left, and this is a sad thing, it just fell by the wayside and then just kind of, you know, into the wind. You know, and then, you know, Ghost Rider went on and just became a joke towards the end. But it's just, I love that Marvel horror stuff. I mean, the earliest parts of the Morbius title and the Night Stalkers specifically, it was a lot of fun. I mean, they took superhero comics and pretty, for, like I said, for a while, pretty well-married elements of horror to them. I mean, you have Morbius still searching for a cure. You have the Night Stalkers going up against the Department of DOA, the Department of Occult Armaments, and stuff like that. And it's just, I don't know, have you guys ever really read into that stuff?
I read a few single issues of Night Stalkers and really, really enjoyed it. I liked the, I was a big vampire fan, so anything with Blade or Dracula, or I mean anyone with fangs, to be honest, I would pick up when I was younger. And those stories I thought were really, really fascinating. It's like, much like the superhero comics, when you pick them up, they reeked of, like, further stories, a huge history, you know, a bigger world. What's that?
I said they tease you like that.
Yeah, yeah. And honestly, you know what I'm most excited about with those is I love the tone of them. And from what I've seen with the way that Marvel is, has slowly been growing as a movie studio, and the news that they have the rights for Blade back, I believe they just got the rights for Ghost Rider back, and they're gearing up Doctor Strange with a horror director. I think it's only a matter of time before we see a cinematic version of that horror universe, you know? And it seems like Marvel is smart enough that they know it's going to need to have that flavor, you know? So who knows if it'll be like a TV series or a number of films or what, but I would love to see like a new version of Blade that was more like that 70s version with the wooden knives and it was just really, really cool. A cool world.
I think that's going to happen. You know, Snipes just got out of prison for his tax evasion, so he's ready for some work.
I know. Yeah. I just can't see them casting him again.
He's great.
He's not bad, but I just think they seem to be doing everything over again. You know what I'm saying?
But he is fantastic.
You got to remember, some motherfucker's always trying to ice skate uphill. Which was the best line in, or one of the best lines in Expendables 3. What were you in prison for? Tax evasion.
Oh, man.
Yeah, they went there.
You know what? They had to keep that series running just so they could get Snipes when he got out.
Although I won't forget I won't forgive them for what they did to Hannibal King and Trinity. I'm sorry. No.
You didn't like Hannibal?
I liked Hannibal King.
The one thing that was a problem with that movie?
Drake.
I mean, Drake was a big issue. I mean, also the lack of Wesley Snipes was sort of an issue.
You know what I said? Not enough Patton Oswalt in that movie. But saying it right here. Not enough.
I agree with that. I will vote for more Patton Oswalt in that movie.
But yeah, no, it's like, I mean, say nothing of, like, enough about Marvel. Like, DC, they've never really had a lot of horror-themed characters. I mean, I remember reading, like, Who's Who back in the 80s, and really the most horror-themed characters that you really come away with in DC, there's Andrew Bennett, I, Vampire, and the Alan Moore, Bernie Wrightson Swamp Thing. And I mean, years down the line, you get like the great Hellblazer series, you know, John Constantine.
Hellblazer, based on the fact that a writer just absolutely fucking loved The Police.
Well, yeah.
Well, actually, no, that's not true. It was actually Steve Bissett, the artist. He drew Sting into the background.
Yeah.
So actually, Steve Bissett had a lot to do with the creation of Constantine. But I want to dispute that they didn't have a lot of horror characters. I don't think it's the case. I think they had quite a few of them. The problem, the reason why maybe they're not associated so much with horror is because many of them got folded into Sandman, which incidentally was initially marketed as a horror book because the first broadsheet you saw, the first advertisements you saw was a picture of Morpheus say, I can show you terror in a handful of sand.
And they've done a lot of horror through Vertigo, too, ever since that.
Right, and there was almost a separation of that. But no, I think there was quite a bit of horror-type characters. A lot of them, I mean, many of them came from Jack Kirby, in fact, through the Demon, through Etrigan and the Demon.
Yes.
I only just learned the other day that the Monkey King, you may remember the Swamp Thing issues that took place where Abby is in, you know, working in a home for autistic children, and they were beset upon by the Monkey King showing them their greatest fears. The Monkey King actually came from the Demon number 2, I believe. So, I mean...
And you also have...
There weren't a lot of DC horror characters. I think they just got a lot of them got buried and then got folded into both Alan Moore's Swamp Thing and then on a greater aspect from Sandman, which followed quite a bit from Swamp Thing.
Let's say they're not nearly as prevalent in DC as they were in Marvel. Like at least you don't think of them as readily as the Marvel stuff.
Well, here's another example that most people forget is Solomon Grundy was much more of a
Born on a Monday
was much more of a horror character until he just until that sort of got pushed
sure
by the wayside. And then there was some of the early Batman stories had certain elements of the story with the Mad Monk and the Monster Men and.
Yeah, Batman dipped into horror all the time, I feel like. And that just, as it got closer to the modern age, that became more and more. You know, you have crossovers as far as, like, with Batman, Dracula, Red Reign, you know? So, I mean, he's walked
through. Yeah, but not even that. I mean, look at some of his rogues gallery, like the Man-Bat, which, okay, yeah, hey, I know, I've only flipped the syllables around and all that, but not only that, but Killer Croc.
Clayface.
Sure.
Yeah, the
ghost of Hugo Strange.
well, you go back to Killer Croc. Is he originally started as a black guy with a skin condition?
Oh well, okay. But things evolved.
But now he has.
Well, yeah.
He eats people.
Well, yeah. I mean, like you said, the Clayface, like the original Clayface, was very much because he was this old Lon Chaney-inspired type horror actor who just put a bunch of makeup on his face and went around stabbing people because, you know, no one respects my art anymore. And then you had...
terrifying in its own way.
Yeah. The second Matt Hagen wasn't really a horror... I mean, it's kind of horrific when you think about this walking pile of muck that, like, turns into other things. Sure, that can be scary, but it's the second, or no, third Clayface, the one who's in love with a... department store mannequin who is basically a walking pile of acidic protoplasm who really only feels any relief when he melts your ass. You know, stuff like that. Like, yeah, it's like DC, yeah, has had these horror-inspired characters. It's just, like I said, not as prevalent as Marvel. I mean, there's even characters like that they've gone and put kind of a horror tinge on, like one of their classic Western characters, El Diablo, originally was just this, you know, Johnny-come-lately Zorro. And then years later, they you know, like he's struck by lightning and he's in like this weird coma for a while. And that's his origin. Years later, they toy with the idea that El Diablo is really like this soulless man. Like he doesn't have a soul. He's got this demon in place of it now. Stuff like that. And then you look at what they did with Jonah Hex. Like,
oh God, after, no.
Well, no, it's like they had the original Jonah Hex. They had.
Are you talking about the movie where he can talk to ghosts? No.
No, I'm not talking about the movie.
Okay, thank God.
Because there was never a movie. It was just a really bad fan film that the movie studio bought and put on the screen. I'm talking about, like, they went from the classic hardcore Man With No Name style comics, the original Jonah Hex. They had the Mad Max, Jonah Hex in the Future. And then they had, when Vertigo became this huge force for kind of DC, like not necessarily independent, but for a lot of independently minded writers that maybe this wouldn't necessarily work as a series, it'll work as an ongoing. And Jonah Hex became like this kind of magnet for weirdness, you know, because they weird had Western stuff like tales. Writers, yeah, weird Western tales, Riders of the Worm and such, where he's going up against like this old, like freak show in the old West and this guy who's like pickling people and turning them into zombies and such like that. Like, eventually, horror does come around to a lot of companies. It just takes a while. I mean, you're talking about horror
comics. That's what happens when you hire Joe Lansdale, one of the pioneers of weird Western tales.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, Jonah Hex for you.
Yeah. And just, oh, crap, I just, go ahead. I had an idea I was going to.
Okay, well, actually, the thing is, you know, I think we sort of ran full circle here with how the comics, you know, the horror comics, you know, started as something that was like a sliver of something, became a dominant force in two companies, and then just sort of slivered back into the mainstream again. And I think that's what I love about it, because you know, you have these horror movies now, and it's like 50% of horror movies now is like is
horror porn.
Yeah, it's torture porn, and it's like, that's not how you do it. I mean, it's the original Fright Night is so much better movie than the new one.
The new one was fun, but it Chris Sarandon is Jerry Dandridge.
I didn't even go see the new one. I mean, I've heard some people tell me to see it, but
you don't.
It was not on my list of like priorities.
I was interested because of David Tennant, but yeah, I never did get around to that one.
Yeah.
Horror is almost universal. Everybody's scared of something.
It was
Not everybody is going to get superpowers. Everybody is scared of something. Whether that be, you know, your own shadow or, you know, horrific images coming from Syria. Yeah. You know, everybody has a primal fear, and, you know, that's, you know, goes to the everlasting appeal of the genre, even though, again, a lot of modern horror gets away gore porn. Or torture porn, and you know, I guess when I was younger, I used to be much more into that. I think now that I'm 41 and, you know, father of two and all this, you know, you tend to step back a little bit and say, ooh, you know, maybe I don't need this, you know.
You know, one thing that that interested me was say what you want about his movies. I heard that Eli Roth once said that the best way to handle a scary movie, if it gets too scary for you, isn't to cover your eyes, but to cover your ears. And I think that to me shows just how much the horror movie industry has lost its ways compared to everyone else, because comics are just visuals. And if a comic can scare the shit out of you, then then you then what does that tell you about these movies where if you cover your ears, oh, you're not that scared anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that the torture porn is on the way out. I mean, it's still kind of hanging on right now, but I feel like that trend has run its course to a degree. You know, I'm hoping that is the path that they're following. But the one thing I will say, I am not the biggest fan of Eli Roth's films, but I love to hear the guy talk about horror. He's just a like encyclopedia of indie horror films. But
he's a fanboy, and who doesn't love listening to a fanboy?
Right, exactly. But that doesn't mean that you act that his flavor is mine. And I will say that what you just said, Ben, is it makes complete sense, because my problem with a lot of torture porn is that the concepts could be terrifying, but they just go overboard with the score, and the effects aren't, as we were talking earlier, they aren't better than what my imagination can come up with, you know? And that subtlety, that ability to suggest something and let the human mind go with it, I think horror directors are doing themselves a disservice if they aren't taking advantage of that to some degree, you know?
Yes. Yeah. All right. So I think we've run full circle on this topic here. Anything? I believe you two had something you wanted to plug.
Yes.
Go ahead.
It's an anthology, a horror comic anthology, and I know that there's a website, skincrawlingcomics.com, where you can see a number of stories that many people than just us have worked on. Jeffrey, do you have anything really to add to that?
Well, actually, my story right now is the one that's currently running on the site. A story called FVK, which was a take on, you know, back when I first created the idea, long before it got accepted into Skin Crawling. It was a take on the really romantic vampires that had been flooding the culture at the time. And so FVK, you know, horror fans or Bad Brains fans tend to recognize the acronym as Fearless Vampire Killers. This stands for Fearless Vampire Kissers. And my story was drawn by a woman named Shanae Williams and colored by Christine Brunson. And I feel awful. I can't remember who lettered it. in any event, mine is the current story that's running. So it's a take on that. It's a 10-page story. And give it a read and hope you enjoy it.
All right. Well, yeah. All right, so let's wrap up here. I hope you all enjoyed our discussion on horror comics, the past era, the present, and the future. This is your host, Ben.
And JT from Saskatoon. This is your turn.
Jeffrey Wessel. Follow me at GD Wessel on Twitter. That's 2 S's, 1 L.
And Brian Dillon, you can follow me on Twitter at Comic Book Slayer, or find the comics I've written at fanboycomics.net.
All right, and we thank you for listening to us, and good night.
So long.